AM 1500, KSTP.
And now, we present the best of Mischke. Tommy's interview with the great baseball player, Billy Werber, who will be 99 years old this year, and yeah, he's still kicking. Bill Werber spent a month hanging out and working out with the 27 Yankees at their invitation. They had seen him play ball at Duke as a freshman and wanted to keep their eyes on him. This was the year of Murderer's Row, making Werber the last living connection to what may be the greatest baseball team ever to take the field. When he graduated from Duke in 1930, he signed on with the Yanks. Before his career would end, he'd play for Boston, Philly, the Giants, and he'd win a World Series with the 1940 Cincinnati Reds as their starting third baseman. Along the way, he'd experience a lot. And people, he remembers it all. So take a trip back to the golden age of baseball with Mischke and the great Billy Werber.
When you went to the Yankees in that summer of 1927, after your freshman year at Duke, was there a feeling inside of being around giants, legends?
No, I didn't. I wasn't in awe of those fellas. As a matter of fact, I was a pretty cocky kid, and I felt I could do the job. I didn't feel welcomed because I wasn't welcomed. Those fellas pretty much went their own way. They were tough, tobacco chewing. That Yankee team was one of the best teams of all time. They won 110 ball games, and they didn't have time to fool with me.
And yet, there you are, perhaps aware, perhaps not, that you're with one of the greatest ball teams that'll ever be seen. A lot of people would say to themselves, this is an extraordinary opportunity.
I left there. I stayed around there about 3 weeks and then left. And the newspapers made quite a deal out of that, amazingly. The newspaper people are in the dugouts and talking to the players, and so what happened to the kid? They say, he left us, and they couldn't understand that. But well, to me, it made sense.
And it made sense to you because you weren't benefiting in terms of your skills.
No, not at all.
It might have been a fun adventure for someone who was going to write a newspaper article, but not for someone who wanted to be a professional athlete.
Yeah. Well, I didn't start out to be a professional athlete. I went to Duke University, and I took a pre-legal course. And when I finished my senior year, I went to Georgetown Law School. But circumstances worked out that I not pursue the law and that I get into baseball. And that's the way it was. But I was never impressed with what was happening. I can give you a little story. One day in Boston, I had Rick Farrell sitting on my left and Lefty Grove sitting on my right. And Lefty Grove was going to pitch that day. Rick Farrell was going to do the catching. And we were laughing and telling stories and batting it back and forth. And Rick Farrell nudged me in the ribs, and he said, can you imagine getting paid for doing this? And that was pretty much the attitude of those fellows in those days.
Was it seen as we're getting paid a lot of money?
Well, we were all paid adequate sums of money. We were paid the salaries of the ordinary ball player would be running from $10,000 up to $15,000. And then the stars like Gehrig and Ruth and Dickey, Gehrig would be getting $30,000 or $35,000. Al Simmons the same, Fox at Philadelphia, and Ruth getting $80,000 a year. But those in relationship to the times were pretty good salaries. I saved money and bought a home.
When you left the summer of 27 because you weren't getting any kind of
attention,
when you left and went back to Duke, how long was it before you were back with those same Yankees?
It was after I graduated from Duke in June of 1930, and I graduated from Duke and joined the Yankees. I received notice to join the Yankees in St. Louis, Missouri, and I reported to the Sportsman Park, the name of the ballpark then in St. Louis, the next day, I got there at about 12 o'clock. The ballplayers didn't get there till about 1.
What was the difference in terms of your reception there versus 1927?
Well, they didn't pay a lot of attention to me, most of the players. I did have three fellows on the club that were very friendly, overtly friendly. Herb Pennock, who was a left-hand pitcher, and Dusty Cook, who was from a North Carolina town and knew of my record at Duke, and Ben Chapman, who was Cook's buddy. And those fellows were very nice to me and rode with me in the cab from the hotel to the ballpark and invited me to have dinner with them. They were very nice. And Herb Pennock told me one thing. He said, be sure, he said, that you're nice to everybody on the way up, because you're going to meet a lot of those fellows on your way back downtown.
Right, right.
Yeah.
When you arrived in the summer of 1930, what do you recall your impressions being of Ruth and Gehrig?
Well, I got to know both of them very well. I got to playing with Bill Dickey against Ruth and Gehrig on all the train rides that were between western cities. Between Chicago and St. Louis, it's about a 2.5-hour ride. Same thing between Detroit and Cleveland. And the minute we get on the train, Babe Ruth would say, cut the cards. So I got to know both of them very well. They were entirely different people. Ruth was boisterous and friendly and a drinker. And Gehrig was quiet and aloof and unfriendly. And Gehrig would knock kids aside, go into his car after a ball game, and Ruth would stand there and sign autographs in perpetuity. Entirely different types of personalities, but both great ball players. And you'd better be a good ball player, too, or they'd get on you.
And when you first found yourself at the plate as a New York Yankee, you had this wonderful day where you get on base twice, you take 10 hits as shortstop, don't make an error. Any reaction from the boys?
I don't know so much that any of them expressed any reaction, but the newspapers the next day, Ruth in that ball game hit 2 home runs and drove in about 5 runs. But the headlines in the paper the next day, and I have a daughter who has the paper, and the story on it, the headlines of the paper the next day featured the day that I had at shortstop.
Now, how would you describe, you described Ruth, you described Gehrig. How would they have described your demeanor, your disposition, your personality?
Well, I can tell you one thing. I was standing in the shower one day, washing my face and hands after a game, and you know how you do, you face the shower and the warm water comes down on your head and you wash under your armpits and all over, and I felt this stream of water in my back that was hotter than the shower, and I turned my around and there was Ruth using my back as a urinal. And somebody said, did you hit him? I said, no, I didn't hit him. I felt like I was being accepted. He was laughing. I was being initiated into the ball club.
I'm going to assume that Babe Ruth liked you.
Yeah, we got along pretty good. Dickie and I always beat him at bridge, but the amounts were modest, $3, $3.50, $4, something like that. Dickie and I were a lot better bridge players, and we were a lot smarter than those two fellows.
Was he a funny man?
Yeah, he was. He was jocular and laughing and liked to joke. But you know, he had a lot of things going for him too. He'd go to the hospitals and visit sick kids, and he'd never take a newspaper man with him or a photographer with him. He never paid any attention to that. I saw him in the Book Cadillac Hotel one day peel off 2 20s and give it to the clubhouse boy that had come up to Willis from Florida and say it was cold. The game was called off. And he said, go buy yourself a warm coat. And the boy came back, and after a half an hour, we were still sitting around the lobby talking. Game called off. And the boy came back to give Babe $20. The coat only cost $20. And he said, no, he says, you keep it. He said, buy yourself some good meals. Now, if he met you, he'd be delighted to see you. He'd buy you a drink. He'd slap you on the back. He'd kid with you and laugh with you. But if he saw you the next day, he wouldn't know you.
And that's because he simply ran into too many people to possibly remember them all?
Well, he didn't pay. Everybody with him was kid. K-double-E-D, Keed. How are you, Keed? I saw Tony Lazzari introduce Miles Thomas to him. Now, Miles Thomas was a relief pitcher with the Yankees, and he'd been there 5 years, 4 or 5 years. And Tony Lazzari said, watch, I'm going to have some fun with Babe. So he brought Miles Thomas over and introduced him to Babe as a kid that had just joined the ball club from Harvard. And Babe stuck out that big paw and shook hands with him and said, glad to have you on the ball club, kid. He accepted him. He was friendly with him. The guy had been with him for 4 or 5 years. Of course, Babe, he didn't see much of him because his fellow only pitched in relief. He had no interest in remembering names. It didn't have to. But he was of kindly disposition. He'd come through, let's take Cleveland. He'd come through the lobby of the Cleveland Hotel going out to the ballpark. And there'd be several fellas sitting around in the lobby. He said, come on, let's go. And they'd go along with him, get in a cab. He'd drive out to League Park. And he'd pay the cab fare and give the cabbie the tip. He never thought anything about that. Man was of a kindly disposition. He hit the hell out of the baseball, though. He was a good competitor. Good competitor.
Gehrig, as a ball player, equally competitive?
More so. More so. He played when he was sick and played when he was hurt. Lou was a non-drinker, a non-smoker. He'd take his mother to St. Petersburg and put her up at the Don Cesar Hotel in spring training. But an aloof fella, an unfriendly fella. I think he only had one good friend on the ball club, and that was Dickie. Ruth liked Lazzari. He never referred to him as Tony. He always called him the WAP. Or the Dago. Now, today people would take offense at that, but not then. They liked each other. Lazzari would nail Ruth's shoes to the floor, and Ruth would cut the arms out of his sweatshirt. That went on all the time.
When you look at baseball today, is it difficult to see what's being done to the game?
It's really pathetic. I wrote a letter to a fellow the other day, and I outlined what I'd do if I was a commissioner of baseball. I'd reinstitute the reserve clause. I'd get rid of the agents that represented the ballplayers. They are non-essential. I'd get rid of those tin helmets. I'd get rid of the use of the gloves, batting gloves. I'd get rid of the shin splints. All of those things consume an awful lot of time in a ball game. The Cincinnati Reds in 1940 and 1939, and I'm not quoting anything from me, I'm quoting a timekeeper, Tom Swope, of the Cincinnati Post. Our average game was an hour and 45 minutes. The average ball game today is over 3 hours. There's entirely too much histrionics that go on. The players do too much posing. We had a great catcher in Ernie Lombardi. And Ernie Lombardi would get down behind the plate and he'd give the pitcher a signal. The pitcher would throw. they didn't go through all of the histrionics that the pitcher does today. They hitch up the belt. They touch the rosin bag. They adjust their cap. The batter walks out of the box and takes three practice swings after every pitch. There's so much time consumed that it's a disgrace. And I had a fellow tell me the other day that he paid $12 for a beer and a hot dog. That's ridiculous. And the average salary is $2,400,000. The ball players are spoiled rotten. I'd get rid of the union. In my days, we didn't have agents. I wouldn't let somebody speak for me. I spoke for myself. The Yankees sold me to Boston, along with George Pipgrass and Dusty Cook and Henry Johnson. Four of us were sold to Boston. Tom Yawkey had bought the Boston team, and the Boston team needed players at certain positions. And so they bought four of us from the Yankees.
And now, back to Mischke's interview with Billy Werber. At 99 years of age, the second oldest former Major League ball player alive today.
And so they bought four of us from the Yankees. The Yankees sold me to Boston. Boston traded me to Philadelphia for Pinky Higgins. Philadelphia sold me to Cincinnati. I retired. Of course, I was making money outside of baseball. But after the 1941 season, I retired. I retired after the 40 season, but I finally decided to play another year with Cincinnati, and I retired after the 1941 season. Well, in January of the 1942 year, Warren Giles called me on the telephone and said that three clubs wanted me to play for them, the Chicago, the New York Giants at the Polo Grounds, and the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he said, I can sell you to any one of these three clubs. Now, if you go to those clubs, I'll give you 10% of the purchase price. I said, what are you selling me for? And he said, $35,000. I said, sell me to the Giants. He said, now, if I send you my check for $3,500 and you decide you're not going to play, will you give it back to me? I said, yes, sir, I will. The check was in the mail.
Were you signing pieces of paper at all back then?
I signed a contract each time with each club. For 1 year. In those days, we didn't believe in long-term contracts because we felt that each year we'd improve our performance and could get more money. So we wouldn't sign a contract for more than 1 year. Now today, these players want 3, 4, 5, and 6 year contracts. What incentive has he got to improve? None.
Right. In 1940, when Cincinnati won the World Series, was that feeling of having climbed that mountain and finally, after being in professional ball since 1930, finally getting that trophy?
It's a big thrill to win a World Series. There's a special aura surrounding it. You have newspaper men from all over America coming and sitting in your dugout. And they have passes, and they want to sit and talk about this and that. There's a great deal of information in the newspapers. It's an awful lot of hullabaloo. Sometimes there's so much hullabaloo that the attitude of the player is, please, God, don't let me make an error. Because if you're the GOAT in the World Series, it becomes emblazoned all over America. And the people in Cincinnati were just delirious with that win. And they'd been that way all season long. And so I was happy to win for the people of Cincinnati. But I didn't get excited about it. I came home and I had a quiet dinner. I packed my automobile. And with Mrs. Werber and the two children, I left Cincinnati the next morning at 7 o'clock. And I drove back to Washington. After a day or two, I was in my father's office working.
Now this is hard for me to understand, and I realize that these were different times, but you've just won the World Series, the golden era of baseball. It's our true one and only national pastime. And how did you fare in that series? You had an incredible series in 40. How did you do?
I led all the hitters.
You led all the hitters.
I led all the hitters on both teams. I hit 370.
And Cincinnati is going crazy over this victory. And you leave the park how soon after the game?
Well, I usually waited for all the people to clear out, because there are always people that want you to sign and talk and one thing or another. And Mrs. Werber waits for half an hour or so and then goes to the car. And we went on home, had a quiet dinner. And I packed the automobile, left the next morning. No big deal.
What was your best year?
I hit 321 in 1934 with the Red Sox, and then I lost my temper one day, and I kicked a bucket full of ice, and I fractured my toe. I broke my toe, and I was never the ball player after that that I was prior to that time.
Who was on the team with you? Who were the best players on the team with the Red Sox when you were there?
Well, Rick Farrell, Jimmy Fox, Wesley Farrell, Lefty Grove, Joe Cronin, Roger Kramer. Had a lot of good players.
How about with Cincinnati?
At Cincinnati, they had a flock of good ones. Ernie Lombardi, catcher. Frank McCormick, first base. Lonnie Fry, shortstop. Me at third base. In the outfield, we had Ival Goodman, Mike McCormick, Harry Kraft. For pitchers, we had Bucky Walters, Paul Derringer, Johnny Vandermeer, Jim Turner, Joe Beggs, Junior Thompson, Milt Schaffner. We had a great pitching staff. Great manager, Bill McKechnie.
Was the Cincinnati crew your favorite team to play with?
I would say so.
Yeah.
That was the best ball club I played with. They were pretty solid, clean-living fellows. The only two fellows on the ball club that were scoundrels were Lee Grissom and Paul Derringer. But Paul Derringer would do his gallivanting on the night after he pitched, and the next day he would get in the outfield and run out the whiskey. And he was ready to go when it was his turn.
You say Ruth didn't actually drink that much.
No. No. You see, if you sit beside a ball player in the heat of the summer, that whiskey, I didn't drink. That whiskey would come out, and you could smell it. Now, I've sat beside Ruth, and I never smell whiskey on him. Now, he would drink. On train rides, he carried a fifth of Seagram's VO in his suitcase. And on train rides, when we were playing bridge, he had a tall glass, and he'd pour out about 8 inches of whiskey with a little ice and a little water. And he'd sit there for 2.5 hours and sip that drink. But he was not a big drinker, nor was he a big eater.
Not a big eater?
No. He'd eat about what you'd do, eat and I'd eat. And you see moving pictures where he takes a roll of bills out of his pocket or out of his roll-up pants and gives the guy a $20 bill for 6 hot dogs and goes in the dirt eating hot dogs. Never happened. Never happened.
And now back to Mischke's interview with Billy Werber. A trip back to baseball's golden age.
Up to how long was a train ride?
Well, when you left Boston, you finished a home series at Boston. You got on a train about 8 o'clock at night. You rode all that night and all the next day. It's about a full day and a half to go to St. Louis. If you open in St. Louis, you were on the train ride a long time. But a train ride from Chicago to St. Louis is about on the Green Diamond Express is about 2.5 hours. So the train rides varied. Sometimes they were long, sometimes it was short. Most of the times, the players would sit and talk baseball.
a lot of times read sports magazines. Sporting News was out of St. Louis. G. Taylor Spink was the editor-in-chief of the Sporting News. And that was a baseball paper. So, and we talked baseball a lot in the lobbies. Say we played baseball games in the afternoon. They were over usually about 5 o'clock. You'd shower at the stadium where you were playing. You'd get in a cab and come back to the hotel. If there was a tap room in the hotel, which there was in most instances, you might go there and have a cold beer, and then you'd have dinner at 6:30, 7 o'clock. You were through that about 8. And then usually you'd go in the lobby and sit around and talk baseball.
I'm trying to picture a hotel in the 30s and 40s. They must have been just elegant places.
All the hotels were top flight. I used to enjoy going in the Coakley Plaza. A man by the name of Riddle owned Man of War. Now, Riddle owned a big farm in Kentucky. He owned a big farm in Berlin, Maryland. And Man of War at that time was the premier racehorse in America. Now, this is all before you were born.
Right.
But Mr. Riddle was a bachelor, a little pink-faced man with a pencil white mustache, and he liked to talk baseball. So he'd sit in the lobby, and he'd ask all of the baseball questions, and the ball players that bet on the races surreptitiously, could he give him a tip on a horse? And nice little old gentleman. He enjoyed our company, and we enjoyed his.
In terms of meeting the owners, did you only talk to the owners around the time that you were making your deal for your pay? Was that it? The only time you talked to an owner?
Well, not exactly. Tom Yawkey. When he acquired the Red Sox in 1933, he had as his general manager Eddie Collins, who was one of the great players of all time, second baseman. A real good player, base runner, hitter, fielder, a college graduate. I think he graduated from Columbia, but I'm not sure. And he had Eddie Collins, and he said, I'd like to go down, he said, into the clubhouse, he said, and meet some of these celebrities. Now, these ball players were, to him, celebrities, but he had millions of dollars, but they were celebrities. So Eddie Collins said to Yawkey, he said, well, you own the ball club. He said, you can go down any time you want to. So he used to come down to the ball club, and the players would come in. You have a 3 o'clock game, but they'd come in before lunch. Ball players usually sleep late and eat a late breakfast, so they wouldn't eat any lunch. You play, you're more effective if you're playing on an empty belly. So most of them played on empty bellies. A little water. And Tom Yawkey used to come down there and play gin rummy with the players. And he was very fond of some of the fellas with whom he played gin rummy, like Lefty Grove and some of the guys like that. He liked Lefty. He owned a big South Island plantation off the coast of Charleston. And he'd invite them down there to hunt wild pig and geese and stuff like that. Nice fellow. Young guy at the time, about, I judge, 33, 34, 35.
Boy, that sounds very unusual to have an owner as young as in some cases some of the players and enjoying their company. I mean, that's just unheard of now.
Well, I tell you how he was. I had an argument with him about salary. I was always arguing with these owners about salary. I felt that I was worth more than I was, and they felt that I wasn't worth as much as I was getting. So I'd had this argument with him, and finally I signed at his figure, which at the time I had to do. And there was a difference, I think, of about $2,500 in between what I wanted and what they were willing to pay me. And in the early part of the year, the Yankees were in there, and a ball was hit high in the air between third base and the Yankee dugout, which wasn't too far off the third base line, and I went over there and the wind was blowing it, and the dugout, you had to go down two steps to get into the floor of the dugout, and I missed the last step, and I fell on my back in the dugout, but the ball was still coming back, and it missed the edge of the dugout roof, concrete roof, I guess about that far, but lying on my back, I caught that ball on the floor of the Yankee dugout with all the Yankees around me hollering at me. The ball, I didn't think anything about it. I guess you could say it was a good play. So, at the end of the day...
Back to Mischke's interview with Billy Werber. At 99 years of age, the second oldest former Major League ball player alive today.
At the end of the day, the clubhouse boy, Johnny Orlando, said Mr. Yawkey would like to see you in the office if you can spare him a few minutes at the end of the game when you've had your shower and gotten dressed. So I went up to the office. He asked me to sit down. And he said, Bill, he said, that was the damnedest catch, he said, I ever saw in all my following baseball. He said, we had a difference of opinion of $2,500 in our what I was willing to pay you and what you were asking for. He said, I'm putting it back in your contract. I had an AP man named Bill Hoddle call me on the phone, a friend of mine. He was with the Washington Star, and he called me on the phone about that time, and he said, it's just come over AP news that you've been sold to Cincinnati. And he said, are you going? And I said, I haven't heard from him yet. I don't know. So then Warren Giles, the general manager, called me and said, we'd like to talk to you. If you're in shape to play ball, we'd like to have you and this, that, and the other thing. I said, Mr. Giles, I'll come down there if you put $1,500 into my contract. And he said, we don't pay that kind of money in the National League. They pay more money in the American League than we do. And I said, well, I'm sorry. And then he called back a little later and he said, why won't you come down here? And I said, if you put the $1,500 in my contract, I'll be glad to show up. Well, I'll talk to Bill McKechnie. Bill McKechnie was the manager, and he was in an exhibition game in Miami someplace. And he came back a little later in the night and called me, and he tried to get me to come down there to talk with him. I said, there's nothing to talk about, Bill. I said, just $1,500. And so then Giles called me about 11:30. He said, we've decided that we'll put the $1,500 in your contract. We want to have you play third base. Come on down. So I went down there, and they put the $1,500 in my contract. And at the end of the year, we won the pennant, and I believe I helped them to win it. He called me at the end of the season and said, we'd like to sign you for next year. And so I said to Tat, he called me in the evening after dinner. I said, he wants to talk contract. I said, what do you think we ought to get? So we decided what we'd get from him. And so the next morning I went down and went by the office, which is not in the ballpark. And he said, we'd like to sign you for next year, and you've had a great year, and we've had a great year. He said, we can pay you more money. He said, what do you want to play for? So I said, I hadn't thought about it, Mr. Giles. I told him, man, a falsehood. I had thought about it. I said, I hadn't thought about it, Mr. Giles. You know what I'm worth. I said, you make me an offer. So I said, we thought we'd pay you $15,000. And I said, well, actually, that's $1,500 more than I had intended to get out of you. I said, so last spring, I said, you didn't make too much fuss about giving me the $1,500. So I said, I'll give it back to you. So I gave it back to him.
So you took $1,500
less than they offered. After I got there and had been with them a little while, I felt that the team had the capacity to win it all in the National League, but also felt that they were a little bit lead-ass. The ball club, all individual players, but the first baseman Frank McCormick, great potential, but he didn't hustle. He hustled at the bat, and when he laid the bat down, he didn't growl at first base. He didn't bounce around on the balls of his feet. He didn't fire the ball. He was lethargic, except when he was at bat. And he was voted the most valuable player after the 1939 series. But he was, but all most of the year he'd been lettuce. So I was thinking of some method of putting some fire into the ball club. I was always mad when I went out there to play. If they were lethargic or indifferent, I got on their ass. And I was mad and stayed mad till the ball game was over.
And that helped you play better?
Well, you won't find anybody that ever played against me who didn't say that I was a hustling son of a bitch. So, anyway... Fry gave me the idea, the second baseman, because he was covered in the shower. He had white and red spots all over his body, liver spots all over his body, birth type of thing. Didn't have any on his neck, face, and he was lithe. He was muscular. He was fast. He was like a jungle cat. He was like a leopard. He had spots all over him. So I called him the Leopard, and I said, fire that ball around, you know, around the infield, strike out. Don't lob that ball to the shortstop or the second baseman. Fire it and growl and get your ass in there. And McCormick said, what do I have to do to get into the Jungle Club? And I said, Frank, you're lead ass. You don't hustle enough. You see, you can help your ball club if you hustle all the time. If you hit a ball into the outfield and the outfielder knows you're going to run hard to make a double out of it, he hustles a little bit, you know, and he might make an error. And if he does, if he hesitates, you can go on to second. So instead of being at first, you're on second base and you've helped your team. So McCormick, he'd hit these singles and he'd end up at first base out of breath. So... I said, Frank, I said, you hustle. And I said, we might consider putting you in the Jungle Club. So maybe a week or so later, you know, every day he'd say, did I hustle good today? I said, Frank, you're improving. And he said, when are you going to take me in the Jungle Club? He said, what are you going to call me? He said, you're going to call me the Wildcat, aren't you? Myers was the Jaguar. I was the Tiger. Fry, the second baseman, was the Leopard. He said, what are you going to call me, the Wildcat? I said, you keep on hustling. And I said, we'll tell you what we're going to call you. So finally in Boston, maybe a month later, he drove in five or six runs and he had a great day. And we're coming back to the Copley Plaza Hotel in the taxi cab. He said, did I hustle good today? Frank, you hustled good. You hustled good. You really are worthy of the Jungle Club. He said, what are you going to call me, the Wildcat? I said, well, when we get down to the Copley Plaza and go in the merry-go-round room and you buy us a couple of beers, we'll tell you what we're going to call you. So he bought the couple of beers and the merry-go-round. I said, now what are you going to call me? I said, Frank, we had a meeting. We're going to call you the Hippopotamus. He said, I don't want to belong to the Jungle Club. I don't want to be the Hippopotamus. I want to be the Wildcat. Frank, he said, you are a Wildcat. And he was hitting that ball, driving in runs. Big guy, 6'4". So he runs into the lobby of the Copley Plaza and he sees Bill McKechnie. He says, I'm in the Jungle Club. They've named me the Wildcat. Like a little kid with a rattle.
What a
wonderful... But those things win pennants.
Those things win pennants, yeah. What a wonderful way to motivate somebody and to have fun doing it.
Yeah.
Wow. Were the fans from the team to team that you went to about the same? Nowadays you hear people compare, say, oh, those New York fans are rough, or all the fans in this place really know their baseball. did the fans change from city to city?
In Cincinnati, they were the greatest. After I'd been there a little while, I had a knock at the door, and I went to the door, and here's a man with a basket, a big bottle of champagne in it, a pineapple, apples, grapes, pears, a fruit basket. And the gentleman said, "I'm Frank Glade." And he said, "I'm from Kroger Grocery and Baking Company." He was a personnel director of Kroger. And he said, "We love the way you play baseball." Had a box at the ballpark. He said, "I just wanted to come out," he said, "and give you this little basket of fruit in appreciation of," he said, "the fire you put into the team." The fans noticed the team was different. And across the road from where I lived was a man with the name of Willie, G. Hedges Willie, and he owned a big lumber company. He was the largest manufacturer of over-the-head doors for garages, roll-up doors, wooden things, and he had 14 acres, a big home, and 14 acres of land. I couldn't see his home from where mine was. And here one time, I could see him walking down his driveway with his wife. His wife had him in tow, and they'd come to welcome us into the community.
KSTP, good old St. Paul, big time, Minneapolis. More with Bill Werber coming up next. And now, back to Mischke's interview with Billy Werber. At 99 years of age, the second oldest former Major League ball player alive today.
Here one time, I could see him walking down his driveway with his wife. His wife had him in tow, and they'd come to welcome us into the community. Now, he didn't want to come. I learned later that they had a big argument about it. He said, "I don't want to meet no damn dumb ball player." And his wife said, "It's our Christian duty to welcome the people into the community." So she was the force that led him to us. He had a box at the ballpark. So they came to make us feel comfortable. Nice Christian people, worth a lot of money. And thereafter, he became a regular visitor. And he'd sit in the box with glasses and watch me. And then after the ball game, here I'd see him coming down the driveway. I'd say, "Tat," I say, I called him Two Gun Willie because he went to pigeon shoots. Nice fellow, old man. I said, here come Two Gun Willie. So he'd come in the house and he'd say, "Son," he said, "you didn't get any hits today." I said, "No, sir, didn't." He said, "Your feet weren't as they were usually." He watched my feet through the glasses. He said they were a little outward instead of toed in. And he said, "I think if you went back to your old stance," he said, "you'd hit the ball better." And a lot of times the old man was right, but he always had some suggestions or criticisms. And then every time I hit a home run, they had a maid that lived in big house. She'd make me a gallon of peach ice cream. So if I had a home run, here comes a peach ice cream. Now, the people in Cincinnati would like that. John J. Schiff, he owned Cincinnati Financial. The man was worth $100 million as an individual. He comes to my house and knocks on the door and says, "I'm Jack Schiff." He says, "I brought you a box of chocolates." I said, "Come on in." And we sat there and chewed the fat. It's all Cincinnati. And nice guy. Just wonderful people. And then you have instances like this. I'm going to the ballpark one day and I pull into the station. I lived about 10 miles outside the city. And you go in to get some gas, and I pull into the gas station, and the boy fills my tank, and he comes to get my money on my card to pay for the gasoline, and he sees who's behind the wheel, and he recognizes me, and he drops down on the concrete where he's pumping gas and folds his hands and looks up at the sky with his eyes closed, and he says, "Please, God, let them win today." And that's how Cincinnati was. Small community, smallest town in Major League Baseball, but so many nice people.
Who was the best pitcher you ever faced?
Well, the guy in the American League that was the toughest fellow for me to hit was Mel Harder, who pitched for Cleveland. And Harder had a good curveball. He had a good sinker ball, had a good fastball, a good change of pace, and he was smart. And he watched you. If you stood back in the box a little off the plate, he'd throw you the curve on the outside corner. If you crowded the plate, he'd throw the sinker ball in on your fist. And he could pretty well guess what I was going to do. So he always gave me trouble. Okay. And then slow ball pitchers always gave me trouble. Like Herb Pennock of the Yankees. Herb had three pitches, slow, slower, and slowest. So I was usually good for about three outs to the third baseman on any day he pitched.
Were there particularly rough opposing team fans?
Just at Brooklyn. Now, at Brooklyn, they were very vociferous. When you took the... I was with Cincinnati in the National League, of course, and going to Brooklyn, we stayed at the Roosevelt Hotel. You'd walk to Grand Central and catch the sub, and then you were underground most of the way, all the way, over to where you got off of the subway at the Brooklyn stop. And you came up from the subway up some stairs to daylight with a walk. And about 15 or 20 feet from that exit, there was a newsstand where a guy sold magazines, newspapers, cigars, cigarettes, candies, gum, stuff like that, a variety type of thing. And when he'd see you come up those steps, he'd holler at you and say, "We'll get you today, you bastards." Well, you can't stop and yank the guy out of the booth and punch him in the nose. You just ignore it and go on walking. And then when you get into the Ebbets Field, you go to your dressing quarters, which are on the first base side of home plate, and between it's a dirt runway between the stadium and the outside walls of the stadium. And when you come out of your dressing room all dressed to go around home plate and out to the third base side where you come up under your dugout, there are bars separating, and these people stand at these bars shaking these things that are driven into the ground, great big iron bars, and you dirty bastards, and they spit through the things at you. And by the time you get to third base, you're in pretty good shape to play the game.
You got that anger you like to play
with.
Yeah,
and things like this will happen. The stands, whenever Cincinnati came there, because Brooklyn had a good team, they were finishing second, third, always good competition. Leo DeRocher was the manager. I didn't like him. And the game starts, doubleheader, let's say, on a Sunday. And the people bring hard-boiled eggs, and they bring bananas, and they bring tomatoes, and they bring oranges, and they suck on the oranges. And then they put them in a paper bag, and they put them under the seat. One time, the doubleheader, a fly ball went up, and in the box seats, and I got to the box seats to reach up. Now the ball was about 12 or 15 feet beyond my reach, but I was at the box seats when this paper bag came between my outstretched hands and missed my face. I could feel the wind of it, and it hit the ground and squashed, and they had banana peelings and egg shells and all this. So I turned to Babe Pinelli umpire. I said, "Interference, interference." He says, "No, Bill." He says, "If it had been interference," he says, "I would have called it." He said, "That ball you couldn't have reached." He very quiet. I made plays like, I never heard of some of the plays I've made. I made some unusual plays. We had a situation in Washington where Buddy Lewis, who was an elect ball player and a good hitter and a good base runner, and he's playing third base for Washington, but he's on second base. Now, Jonathan Stone, who's hitting 3 or 4 on the Washington team, is up. Now, the situation is such. Jonathan Stone is a left-hand hitter. He's a long ball hitter. He's very fast runner. He's a good hitter. He's got to drive that run in because they've got to have it. So, defensively, he's a pull hitter. So I'm away off of third base and I'm way back on the grass. And he hits the ball and it's a chopper down the third baseline. So I run as fast as I can, and as I backhand the ball like that, I see Lewis go in front of me. Lewis is a good base runner, so I know he's going to turn third to see if I make a bad throw to first, and I take the ball out of my glove and I wham! I throw it as hard as I can to first base, but don't let go of the ball. Instead of that, I turn and run for third base, and Lewis is halfway home. Clyde Milan, the coach, is hollering, "Get back! Get back!" And I dive on the overside of the base and catch Buddy. He's got eyes as big as a deer's, coming back into third base, and he's out. That retires the side. In Chicago one day, we've got a guy that is, the situation is somewhat similar, and the ball is topped and comes down to third base. I know I can't get the runner because he's fast, but I come in and the guy that's on second base has come and he's made his turn at third base, and I come in and I grab the ball with one hand like that and I throw it to first base, but I don't let go of the ball, and I use the propulsion of the throw to turn my body, and I'm headed now toward third base, and I catch the guy that's come halfway home, and he's out. We're out of the inning. Now, another time in Chicago, I'm on third base, and Dusty Cook of the Boston Red Sox is on first base, and Vern Kennedy is the pitcher, and Zeke Benora is the first baseman. So Vern Kennedy likes to throw to first base. He's got a good first base move. So he throws to first base to get Cook. I'm on third, and Cook's back safe, and Zeke Benora, a big old Italian boy, good-natured fellow, he bounces around like a big old bear, you know, and slaps the back of his glove, and he lobs the ball to Kennedy. He says, "Come on, Vern, old boy," and he lobs the ball to Kennedy, and I say to myself on third base, I said, if he does that again, I said, I'm going on home. So, sure enough, Vern takes his stretch and throws to first base, and Zeke comes bouncing out there. He said, "Come on, Vern, old boy." And when the ball was still on his fingertips, I start out for home, and I slide across home safe with a winning run. So Jimmy Dykes, who's the manager, fines Benora $250. And the next day, when I'm coming down from the clubhouse, I have to come through the end of the Chicago dugout. Benora's waiting for me. Now, he's a big, burly guy, you know, he grabs me around the waist and squeezes me. I said, "Turn me loose, Zeke." I said, "You're cracking my ribs." He says, "That's a general idea." And he said, "You cost old Zeke $250. He says, "You've got to pay that fine." So,
wasn't there a story of an opposing, I asked you earlier about opposing team fans. Wasn't there a story you told me once about an opposing team fan who got on you where you eventually had to go deck him?
I'd gone to the Athletics, and the fellow was sitting in the box seat with a white coat on, nicely dressed, white coat, and he kept that up during the ball game and the latter part of the ball game. I said, "I'm going to take care of that loudmouth in that box seat." So the runway was crushed cinder, black, and so I got a double handful of that crushed cinder. And I went over there and I threw it in the fellow's chest and went all down over his white coat. And so after the ball game, the bat boy came to where I was undressing to take a shower and said, "The man out there that you threw the dirt on is at the door." And I said, "Tell that son of a bitch to stay there." And I laced up my pants. And I went to the door prepared to grab him and drag him into the clubhouse and put him under the shower. So I said, "Mr. Warby," said, "I'm awful sorry." He said, "I didn't mean to give offense." He said, "I was wrong." He said, "We're the guests of the ball club." He said, "I'm a war veteran in a hospital out here." He said, "We're guests of the ball club." He said, "I want to apologize." And I felt badly. I said, "Yes, sir."
And now back to Mischke's interview with Billy Werber, a trip back to baseball's golden age.
Did you have a dislike for the opposing team? I mean, did you have to dislike them to play them hard?
We had a no fraternization policy that had come down as an edict from Judge Landis. And you were not allowed to talk to anybody in the stands, and you were not allowed to talk to the other ball players. You were not allowed to go up to the batting cage while they were batting and visiting with any of them. They're all chummy nowadays. When the ball game started, we were out there to beat the son of bitches. We didn't like them. I never liked them. I admired a lot of them. I admired Terry Moore of the Cardinals. That guy made one of the greatest plays I ever saw. Frank McCormick was our batter, and Frank McCormick hit a line drive to left center field, and it would have gone into the left center field bleachers. Line drive all the way, and that Terry Moore broke from right field, and just before he got to the bleachers, he jumped up and caught that ball in his bare hand, just like this.
With his bare hand?
With his bare hand. One of the greatest plays I ever saw. I went from home to third on a base on balls one time. Nobody's ever done that.
Oh, third on a base on balls?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, I tell you, George Moriarty was an umpire. And George Moriarty was a ball player. He played for Detroit, same time Cobb did. So George Moriarty liked to dress and come in and sit in the dugout before the ball games and come in there and chew the fat. And I was the leading base dealer. So George would say to me, he said, "Have you ever stolen second on a base on balls?" And I said, "No." I said, "But George Whitted told me about it when I was playing at Duke." Now, George Whitted was a good, savvy ball player. He was my coach at Duke the first 2 years, and he played in the major leagues about 11 years. I said, "George Whitted told me about it, and I knew how it was done." So on this particular day, Schoolboy Rowe is pitching for his 16th consecutive win. and Ray Hayworth as the catcher. Now, in about the seventh or eighth inning, they are one run ahead. And he walks me. I get a base on balls. Nobody on base. And when I'm running down the first base, I'm looking at short and I'm looking second. I'm still thinking about what George Moriarty told me. And Billy Rogel had his back to the infield, and Gehringer had on second was the same way. So about 15 feet from the bag, I turned on a burst of speed, and I hit the bag. It's gone towards second. Hayworth was arguing with the umpire about the base on balls, about the umpire missing the last ball. So he still had the ball in his hand. And the stands all saw me burst for second. They had about 35,000, 40,000 people in the stands to see Schoolboy Rowe win or lose his 16th game. Oh, they roar. So Rogel turns around and Gehringer turns around, and here they see me coming for second. They run to second base. Hayworth throws the ball and goes through second base to JoJo White in center field. I hit the dirt and I'm up and going to third, where I score on a sacrifice fly and tie the ball game.
Connie Mack.
I loved him. Nice old man. Connie Mack was solicitous of his ball players. If you made a mistake in a ball game, he wasn't like Joe McCarthy, you dumb bastard. He'd wait until the next day, and then he'd ask the club houseboy, would you ask Mr. Werber if he could come in for a few minutes before he goes out to take batting practice? And you'd go into his room, and he'd say, thank you for coming in. And we had a play yesterday, and then he'd outline the play and say, you did it this way. Do you think it would have been better if you'd done it that way? The old man was pretty shrewd, and he was not, his argument was so solid that you couldn't say your way would have been better. Well, he said, would you mind if it comes up again? He said, doing it my way. Well, you save the humiliation of being bawled out in front of your teammates, and you appreciate the nicety of the manner in which he's outlaid it for you. Nice fellow. I want to tell you a play one time that Gehring made. I never saw anybody make a play like this. In Yankee Stadium, here's home plate, and here's first base, and the bleacher comes out like that. And Roos usually playing right field. Now, a ball that is hit by the batter that curves inside first base, you know, mm-hmm. will hit that wall, and it'll carry him off this way, carry him off that way, carry him off some other way. The batter that hits that thing, he's going to go for two bases all the time. And if the right fielder isn't good at judging how that ball's going to carry him off, he can maybe go to third base. Well, one day I saw a batter hit the ball that curved like that and went out like that. And Ruth had a little difficulty getting with it. And Ruth threw the ball to third base. The rider was going there. Who do you suppose was backing up the play?
Gehring.
He had come all the way across the pitcher's box and was over there backing up that damn play. The damnest thing I ever saw.
Came from first.
Yeah.
That kind of hustle.
He's out of the play when the ball goes by him. He's out of the play, so what can I do to be an asset? So he's over there back up. Great ball player.
I want to throw one other thing at you here, and just tell me if I'm hitting anything that isn't accurate. Cincinnati won its first pennant in two decades during 39. Not bad for a franchise that had endured four last-place finishes in the early 30s. Unfortunately, the Yankees awaited them in the World Series and swept the Reds for their fourth straight title. Entering the 40 campaign, The Reds aimed a little higher. Bucky Walters and Paul Derringer led a 1-2 punch on the mound, providing Cincinnati with the best pitching in the National League. Walters led...
In both leagues.
Okay, in both leagues. All right. Walters led the league in wins and ERA for a second straight season, going 22-10 with a 2.48 ERA. Derringer, who had won a World Series title as a member of the Cardinals in 31, contributed 20 wins. Junior Thompson, in just his second major league season, was a solid number three man as the Reds allowed 100 fewer runs than any other senior circuit club.
He called me on the phone. He's living down in Tucson, Arizona, Gene Thompson. Said he was a little bit old and having some troubles, still married to Doris. He's still alive.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, here's what I got to ask you about, because this must have been difficult. Unfortunately, all was not well.
And now, back to Mischke's interview with Billy Werber. At 99 years of age, the second oldest former Major League ballplayer alive today.
Now, here's what I got to ask you about, because this must have been difficult. Unfortunately, all was not well with one of the Reds. On August 3rd, while on a road trip in Boston, backup catcher...
Cut his throat.
Hershberger committed suicide. What
he cut his throat in the Copa Plaza Hotel and leaned over the tub and bled to death. One of the nicest kids on the club. I had introduced him to a girl at the hospital. I'd been going to the hospital for massages on my leg. And I met this nurse there and became friendly with her, pleasant, conversational, nice girl. I said, there's a boy on the club you ought to meet. And I introduced him. And I asked him later about it. And he said they were going together and seeing movies together and things like that. Said, he was catching a ball game. Lombardi had sprained his ankle. And Hershberger was drafted. It was during the dog days of August. The team hit a little slump. And we were losing ball games in the East. In the game, McKechnie, Hershey was catching doubleheaders where the doubleheaders came up. McKechnie was giving him teaspoons full of brandy. The sixth or seventh inning to kind of pep him up. In this night game at the Giants, Bucky Walters, the last of the ninth, has got the Giants 4-1. Walters is our most dependable pitcher. He walks Burgess Whitehead. The next batter is Ott, and he hits a home run. Now the score is 4-3. He walks the next batter, which is Mickey Whittick, and Denning hits a home run. Now the score is 5-4 in the ninth inning, and Walters has lost a game that was in the bag 4-1. We open in Boston the next day. No, the next day is off day in Boston. Hershberger's right here in his berth, and I'm right here, right across the aisle from him on the train, leaving to go to Boston. And, oh, Bill, he said, if Lom had been in there, he said, we'd never lost that ball game. I said, Hershey, I said, it happens. I said, don't bother about it. I said, we got a 10-game lead. We had so many good pitchers, stoppers. I said, depends on the bat. Oh, Bill, he says, I gave the ball game away. I gave the ball game away. And he just kept on talking to that. Finally, I got him settled down. You didn't have anything to do with losing the ball game. I said, we all lost the ball game. We all hate it. But, oh, I lost the ball. The next morning at the Copley Plaza Hotel, we have an off day in Boston. And I have breakfast with him by accident. And he's still moaning about this. He's bothered about this game that he's lost, that he's lost. And I persuade him to go downtown with me. We went to see Maryland, My Maryland, with Walter Brennan, a very good show. And two, three times he got up and left me during the show, but he always came back and said he needed smoke.
And then we walked back to the Copley Plaza Hotel, and that's the last I saw of him. Now, the next day, he didn't show up at the ballpark. So we have to put Bill Baker in a third-string catcher to catch the ball game. And Gabe Paul, who's traveling secretary, Gabe Paul calls the manager and says, go to Hershberger's room and see if you can find him. So the manager went there and found him in the bathroom. He'd taken off all his clothes except his shorts, and he'd taken a safety razor blade, and he'd hacked in his throat until he hit that aorta, and it threw blood up the side of the wall, pretty near the ceiling, and he leaned over the bathtub and bled to death. Nice kid. Nice boy. Now, he was sort of a hypochondriac, and the ball players used to, the ball players inadvertently contributed to his suicide, because Hershey would come in and go to Doc Rohde and said, Doc, look at my eyes. He said, aren't they yellow? And Doc Rohde was a very intelligent fellow. He'd boost him up. You look great, Hershey. You look great. Your color's good. He'd boost him up, you know, And
so the fellows on the team would ride him about the hypochondriac?
Yeah. Yeah. But they loved him. Right. A guy that they don't like, they leave alone.
Right.
But a guy that they're fond of, if they can find some little thing that they can stick him with, they'll stick him with it. It's cruelty in a way. His father had killed himself, committed suicide. His father's brother, his uncle, had committed suicide. Nice fella. We awarded his mother a World Series check, $5,865.08.
How does a team, when something like this happens, still go on to this great success? That seems like such a...
You know what McKechnie did? He said to Jimmy Wilson, who was a coach and hadn't caught a game in 2 or 3 years, Bill Baker doesn't have enough experience to get in here. We're going to play Detroit in the World Series. He says, you're my catcher. So Jimmy Wilson went off the coaching lines and did all the catching. We don't have Lombardi. Now, let me tell you another thing that happened. Lonnie Fryer, our second baseman, star second baseman, goes to the water cooler to get a drink of water at the end of the dugout. And the water cooler is sitting precipitously on a block of ice. And as he's there, it slid off and fell across and broke his great toe on his right foot. He played no games in the World Series either. So we had Jimmy Wilson, a cripple, played with Charlie horses in both legs, and his hand puffed up like an adder. And not a second baseman Fry. Juice came in there and did a hell of a job.
What happened after the suicide? Did they have a team meeting and say, boys, this is where we're at. This is a terrible thing, but we just got to go on?
Yeah, McKechnie did. And McKechnie marshaled his forces together. And Bill McKechnie.
Did you guys as a team go to the funeral?
I think the funeral was held in California. But before the World Series, they put a decorated monument at home plate in the moment of silence in honor of his memory. It was a blow, but you have to pick up and go on. He was as well liked a ball player as he was on the club, and he was missed.
You were going to mention something about...
And now back to Mischke's interview with Billy Werber, a trip back to baseball's golden age.
You were going to mention something about Edwin Lee Wells.
Ed was a rookie that came up to the Yankees, and he's going to be married in the fall. In the Book Cadillac Hotel, Ruth came to him one day and said, Ed, I want you to go with me tonight. He said, I got a couple of girls, go out to play some cards and entertain. And Ed said, no, I don't want to go. But Babe insisted, and you can't say no to Ruth. So he finally agreed to go along. And Babe said to him, the girls would like to have a drink. and said, get a fifth of gin, and I'll get some oranges, and we'll mix a drink while we're playing cards. So I had got a fifth of gin, and babe got a basket of oranges. And when they knocked on the door, instead of the girls appearing, this is on the suburbs of Detroit, a big burly-looking guy said, so you're the guys that have been after my wife. And babe says, run, Ed, run for your life. And the guy shot, bang, bang, bang. And Ed feels 3 watts, hit him in the back like that. My God, he says, I'm dead. So he tears out this, and he tears out, and he goes, turns right instead of left, and runs into a big wall across the road. They were doing some construction. Gets back to the hotel about 12 o'clock at night, ashen-faced. And the guys are sitting around the lobby with strong, long faces waiting for him to come in. And Tony Lazzari says, Ed, babe's upstairs. He's dying. He's asking for you. So they take him up there. They got Ruth all laid out on the bed with talcum powder all over his face and ketchup all over his shirt. And they say, he's dying, Ed. And Ed says, oh, my God. Passes out on the floor.
How did he arrange to have something actually hit him? You said something actually hit his back.
Wads. They'd taken the bullets out of the gun, and the wad was hitting him. See, between the powder and the bullet, there's a containing the powder, there's a little paper thing, and there's a paper wadding that were hitting him in the back. Then they had the whole thing. Ruth had it set up.
All set up.
Yeah, set up.
Talk about elaborate. It's one thing to nail a guy's shoes to the floor, but to go through all that work for a joke.
Well, it happened a number of times. It happened with Ed Smith with the Philadelphia Athletics, and he was taken to a suburb out of Lake Charles. And when the guy said, so you're the guy fooling around with my wife, and they pulled out a gun, shot him. Ed, the Phillies had guys lined up along a dirt road where he had to go the way he'd come, and with guns. And each time as Ed passed him, they were going to shoot to Ed. But he didn't come up the road. He went through the woods straight ahead of him and dove into the Lake Charles River and swam 100 yards underwater. Got back to the hotel about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning.
Was Babe the king of practical jokes on the team?
Well, he was always pulling them, and they were always pulled on him. He didn't mind. He was a good-natured fellow.
Yeah.
He liked it.
Doesn't sound, I'd never heard you, it doesn't sound like there was anyone on the team that Babe disliked.
No, he wasn't a man that disliked anybody. He was uniformly good-natured, except when the ball game started. And then he didn't want any foolishness. He wanted all business. And you couldn't offend him. He had, later on, he had shirts that came down. The buttons came down here, so they had a tail here and a tail here. And he'd have his shirts special made so that the eyelets down here were hemmed. And he'd take a piece of 2-inch gauze here and then run it through the one here and tie them under his legs so that when he swung the ball, his shirt wouldn't come up over his belly. Well, Lazzari and Reese and some of the guys that were always horsing around with him, Reese, Jimmy Reese, second baseman, he cut those straps out. Well, one day Ruth caught him cutting the straps and he hung him up in the locker, rolled up his shirt. Reese was a little fella and maybe 150 pounds. And Babe rolled the shirt up and then the Yankee lockers were big, and they had 2 hooks come out of it. Hung Reese on the locker. And, oh, Babe, he said, let me down, let me down. And Babe would say, hang there. You look like a little monkey hanging in the locker. And he said, hang there. So Ruth got a couple of hits. He felt that was a good omen, so the next day he'd come out and he says, where's that little monkey Reese? And he'd tear his shirt up and hang him in the locker. So this went on, Babe went hitless. All kinds of jokes that played on each other.
When you would steal bases, did you have a certain approach to it that was just sort of your own?
Stealing bases in my day was a matter of helping your team to win games. Now, in Cincinnati, I stole very few bases because I was leaning off, and most of the time I was leaning off. So that means that when you're on first base, you're hitting in front of some good long ball hitters. Now, in Cincinnati, for example, Goodman was hitting third, Lombardi was hitting, McCormick's hitting fourth, Lombardi's hitting fifth. Now, these three fellows were all long ball hitters. Now, if I was on first base and there was one out or two outs, it doesn't pay for me to start to steal a base. Stay on the base and not run the risk of running, because these guys hit the long ball and they hit a double, I can score on it. You only stole when you could help your ball club.
Okay. When you would play, would there be base stealers as good as you on the team? Or were you generally the fastest?
I thought I was the fastest. At most ball clubs, I was. But Fox taught me a lesson in Boston. He was playing first, and at the end of the season, last day when the Yankees are in Boston, or the Boston's in the Yankees, they have a field day, have all sorts of events, and they have a 100-yard dash. And in Boston, there was Fox and Dusty Cook and myself, and the Yankees, they had Ben Chapman and possibly Merle Hogue and Sam Bird or Jake Powell, the six fellas running, and I jumped the gun. Had a starter with a gun, said, "All right, Mark, get set," and I jumped. When the gun went off, I was about 6 feet ahead of the field, and I thought I'd hear a second shot call me back, but to let it go. Well, at about 85 yards, I felt a body coming up on me. I could feel him. And there wasn't Chapman, who was a great base stealer and a fast runner. It was Fox. And Fox got the $100. And I'd been all on him all season about hitting the ball off the wall in second base. I said, "Jimmy," I said, "if you run hard to first base, you could make a double out of that and help the team." And he'd say, "Oh, Bill," he said, "you know I'm not as fast as you are." He'd hit a ball off that left field wall, and he'd pull up at first base. And I'd hit a ball off that left field wall, and I'd go sliding into second. He was lazy. But for $100, he could run. 40 years later, I read a book on Fox written by Norman Mock, a professional writer at Eastern Maryland. And he described Fox's senior year at Huddlersville in the Maryland State track meet. He won the 100-yard dash, the 200-yard dash, the broad jump, the high jump, the shot put, the discus throw.
Fox did all that?
Yeah. A more beautiful guy you never saw in your life. When I saw him stripped in the shower, I determined I'd never gonna fight with a man unless he took his coat off for me and I could see what he had on his shirt. Muscles all over. Big bicep, big wrist, big hands, thighs, calves. Just a stud. And I saw him later in life. His head looked like a pumpkin. His teeth were bad. He died a pauper. Yeah. Not a nickel to his name.
KSTP, good old St. Paul, big time Minneapolis. That was Billy Werber with Mishki. What's coming up next? Oh, that must be GL. Stay tuned. Right after Paul Harvey Jr., Garage Logic.